I have arrived, folks. Your excuse to drink at any point in any day is here right now, and all it requires you to do is turn on this podcast. This is the QTR Podcast. Today is July 11th, 2019. Before we get started, this podcast is... What the fuck is that? Sorry, these fucking speakers. Unbelievable. Okay, sorry, this podcast is brought to you by my patrons. Patrons are people that choose to make a monthly recurring donation through Patreon. You guys are the lifeblood of the podcast, and right now, as I am trying to focus a lot of my effort on the podcast, the patrons are vital, and I appreciate the shit out of them. So, if you're listening, maybe you were thinking about becoming a patron at one point in the past, you hadn't done it, now would be the time to do it, ladies and gentlemen, because I'm trying to focus more time and energy onto the podcast, trying to produce more content and more episodes. I want to shout out some of the patrons that have supported the podcast for a while and some of those that have come through in a big way. First and foremost are my friends over at The Trader's Path. The Trader's Path is basically a no-bullshit trading service. You can log on every day. They're going to give you a live stream of their trades. They're going to give you investor education. They're going to give you watch lists for the day. And The Trader's Path was started by a guy who defected from one of these other bullshit Jason Bond-style trading services. They decided they wanted to do something different. If you've ever signed up for Jason Bond, Tim Sykes, you didn't like it, maybe the Trader's Path is for you. It's something different. It's no bullshit. There's no front running. There's no nonsense. It's investor advocacy and investor education, so check them out. This podcast is also brought to you by my friends over at the Sang Lucci Trading Steam Room. Sang Lucci is the options OG. Sang Lucci and the Steam Room, what they do over there is they track options flow. They track money that comes into the options market, and they follow the big money. They point out in the Steam Room where the big money in the options market is going, which can often precede moves in an equity one way or the other. Sometimes it doesn't, but other times it does, and it's great to understand what is happening and where the money is going, when it's going there, and why it's going there. And that's all they focus on over at the Sang Lucci Steam Room. They also offer a master course and education in how to read tape, market psychology, following options flow. I've known these guys for 7 or 8 years. They're some of the smartest guys I've ever met. I've learned a ton from them. I follow them every day. I have them on push alerts on Twitter. So give Sang Lucci and Wall Street Jesus and the Sang Lucci Steam Room a shout. They are also in the podcast description. This podcast is also brought to you by Rumorhound. Rumorhound is a AI-based service that helps you sort through the mergers and acquisitions rumors that you see on a daily basis. You see them on Twitter, you see them in chat rooms that you're in, and Rumorhound takes these mostly rumors. You know, sometimes they are they're news events that a company may be considering something, but it'll take this information, it considers the source, it considers the timing, it considers the equities involved, and it runs it through their proprietary artificial intelligence system to then get back to you and let you know which of these rumors may have credibility and which ones may not have credibility. So between the Trader's Path, Rumorhound, and Sang Lucci, you can get some deep insights to the market that you might not have if you're just sitting around eating fucking bonbons on a daily basis. By the way, there's nothing wrong with that. This podcast also brought to you by my friends over at Hella Bacon. They shoot machine guns out of helicopters in Texas. My friends over at Corvus Gold. My homeboy Piggly Wiggly is in the house. Nathan Michaud and the Investors Underground crew, and also Traders for a Cause, the number one trading charitable organization. I love the fuck out of those guys. I'll be at their event in Vegas. Chris Boas, Ken R., Chris B., Nicholas Parks, my buddy Matt Zimmer out on the left coast, my homeboy Russ Valenti, and finally, just some of my newest patrons and some people that have been with me for a little while, Carl Nixon, Wallaby390, Carson Rasmussen, I appreciate you. My homeboy William Davis, my buddy Bo Baldwin and Cullen Newland, some of my older patrons, DC Brown, Steven Rasputic, Aurelian Briere, you guys have been with me forever, James Kareen, I appreciate you, Carter Bell, Glenn Tung, thank you so much, brother, I think that's Whitney Tilson's buddy, Louis Chang, I appreciate you, Lyle Engel, Voltiface Investments, my homegirl Devin's in the house, I always see her, Brian Weckman, Chris Bunting, a guy whose name is just blocked by Mark Spiegel. We'll have to discuss that in a second. John Portwood, Nicholas Sutton, Brian Hall, Steve Helly, I appreciate you guys very much. Two other things before we get started. First and foremost, I am not an investment advisor. So what do you think about that shit, folks? I don't know what I'm talking about. I hold no licenses. I hold no registrations. Do your research elsewhere. I'm here mostly for cathartic psychotherapy purposes, to come up here and puke into a microphone while having a cocktail, all right? Or as I like to call it, any given fucking weekday. And you shouldn't listen to anything that I say. Do your research elsewhere is the motto of this podcast, which means turn it off right now and go listen to something else. Also, this podcast has a 2-drink minimum. Ladies and gentlemen, liquor, beer, wine, there's lots of ways to get it done. I'm going to leave the rest up to you, all right? Maybe you can write me a little note if you sign up as a patron and let me know exactly how drunk you had to get in order to be convinced to sign up as a Patreon, at which point I will encourage people in the future to reach that specific level of drunkenness. All right. With that being said, ladies and gentlemen, I am here with the scourge of the financial industry on the phone with me. Banned from CNBC, banned from Fox News.
How do you soon, get guests on this fucking show?
Soon,
you treat them like that.
Soon to be like... soon to be banned from Twitter. I have Mark Spiegel of Stanfield Capital in the house. What's going on, brother Mark?
Hey, good. How are you, man? Thank you for having me on again.
I'm doing quite well. I just got your text message you sent me a moment ago when Twitter went down, and you said, I feel so empty inside. And I just said, you know, are you sure maybe you didn't feel like that before Twitter went down also?
And I said, I did. It's just that Twitter disguised it. That's why people take drugs, right? I mean, I wouldn't know about that, but you would, right, Chris?
Look, there's various things I know about, various things I don't know about. It could be because, you know, one explanation, maybe Twitter was scrubbing its servers of photographs of Jeffrey Epstein and Bill Clinton, like Google allegedly did. Did you hear about that?
You know, it seems this thing should be pretty easy to resolve, right? Bill puts out a press release. I think he said something like, I've only been on his plane 4 times, twice to summits in Europe, twice somewhere else, the Secret Service there. And then one of the women involved was like, oh, no, I've seen him there 27 times or so. So what is it? I mean, you know, this guy has Secret Service protection 24/7. Can't we just access those logs and see where he was on all these different dates?
We don't even need to do the pilot logs, Mark. The pilot logs show that he was on the plane 27 times.
You mean Epstein's pilot writes down the name of each passenger?
The flight logs. They put down the initials of every passenger. And if you go, Zero Hedge actually has the flight logs on one of their articles about Jeffrey Epstein. So if you go Google it when you're done with this, it shows on the flight logs. You know, one says Bill Clinton, I think, and then the successive ones say BC plus Secret Service, whatever. And, you know, he was on the plane like 27 times.
Well,
and people go, oh, Trump, Trump, Trump. You know, look, Trump, I'm sure Trump was friends with him also, too. And they had parties together, I was reading, you know. You'll be shocked to hear that these parties included young women and cocaine, Mark. But I didn't see Trump on the flight log. So that's why I always bring up Bill Clinton first. And people give me shit. Oh, you're biased. I'm not biased. Like if Trump is found to be guilty, then he's found to be guilty, too. I'm not denying that Trump didn't have any involvement with Epstein, because he certainly did, right? But he's not. Well, I don't see him on the flight logs.
So I will look into those flight logs. Look, Zero Hedge is to me, it's two different websites. It's really brilliant financial insights from, you know, Tyler, and they say Tyler's a few people. So whoever writes under that byline, really, you know, sharp stuff, funny stuff. Yeah, you know, they highlight the negative data, but you know, so what? The rest of the media highlights the positive data.
Right.
So data's data, and you just have to realize what you're looking at. But then the other part of Zero Hedge are, you know, a lot of just, you know, kind of nut job bloggers who get posted there. So, I mean, did this flight log come from Tyler, whom I trust, or from like a nut job blogger?
No, it's his legitimate flight logs. It came from a reputable source. I mean, that's not the only site that's had him.
So, how can Clinton put out, I mean, this blatant lying press release? It's almost astounding. Well, has he been called on it yet? Yeah, I mean, has Fox called him on it yet? I mean, okay, so the New York Times probably won't, but so, you know, I'm sure somebody would call him on it, right?
Yeah, I'm not really sure because I didn't see the press release that you're talking about where he said he was only on the flight four times.
Which, yeah, it was an official statement from Clinton. Anyway, all right, we'll look into it. Look, as far as Trump goes, I know almost for a fact that guy just does not use drugs, and
he definitely doesn't use drugs.
And he's never even had a drink in his life, maybe early in his days, because there's alcoholism that runs in his family.
Yeah,
so
his brother died of alcoholism, right?
Yeah, so you have to give him credit for supposedly throwing Epstein out of Mar-a-Lago for, like, hitting on the chicks who were too young there.
But he may not use drugs or use alcohol, but that doesn't mean he doesn't use young women.
No, but I haven't heard any. Well, we'll see. Look, we'll see. I doubt that Trump would have gotten involved with anybody, you know, under the age of 18. I doubt it. You know?
Yeah, I'm skeptical of it too. You know, and we'll see what the evidence. You know, this is like the Mueller report, right? What did I say when the Mueller report when Mueller was appointed to look into Russiagate? I was having a discussion with my friend, actually, who used to be my nemesis in Herbalife, the skeptic. I think I was talking to him on Twitter DM, and I said to him, I'm going to respect the outcome of Mueller's investigation regardless, because at the time that Mueller was appointed, both the left and the right, Mark, had agreed that his pedigree was substantial enough that he would be an objective kind of third party to look at things and investigate them, and that he would do the right thing. And then, of course...
Yeah, and then, of course, once it was done, like, I know, yeah, you know, then it was not a good report, and it was a cover-up, and we have to keep digging. Sure, yeah.
Right, exactly, same deal. So, likewise, if Epstein winds up going to trial, Mark, I think that a lot of rocks are going to get turned over.
If Epstein lives to the trial,
exactly.
I would not want to be that guy's, bodyguard, right? Of course, you know. Look, the flip side of that is, right? I mean, one of the theories about Epstein, because as you may know, and I put it on Twitter over the weekend, I couldn't find any SEC filings on the guy. I found one obscure, 13G from years ago in some shit ass company, and nothing else. And you know, all these people claim they never did any business with him. It came out today that he lost, I think, 100-something million in DBs were in 08 when that fund blew up. But certainly nothing to make sense of his alleged, multi-billion-dollar portfolio, right? So the theory, of course, which you've heard, is that, he's blackmailing these billionaires, right? He's setting them up with the young chicks and filming them. But you'd think one of those guys would have had him killed already, like they're going to kill him now. You know what I mean?
Look, man, people around the Clintons have just turned up missing.
Right.
They just disappeared.
But what were they waiting for? What were they waiting for? Why didn't Bill have this guy rubbed out a long time ago?
I don't know. Well, there's a very good chance that they thought it was over and done with, right?
This is turning into the Alex Jones.
Well, I don't give a fuck. We're just having a discussion. But Mark, listen.
A discussion.
What do you think this is? We're just two idiots. We're just talking about this, right? But like, what do you think? I mean, don't you think that the Clintons may have assumed that this was over when he got that sweetheart deal some years back, and that maybe this had been brushed under the rug?
Yes, that's a fair assumption.
Right.
That is
so
a fair
there's
assumption.
No need to kill him then. But, if somebody's if he turns up dead now, there's going to be a lot of questions. Likewise, if people around this start to wind up turning up missing, it's not going to be a coincidence, right?
Yeah, if I were Jeff, the first thing I would do is call a press conference and say, hey, here's my electrocardiogram. I'm in perfect health.
Right.
I have no suicidal thoughts whatsoever. If anything, I'm looking forward to a little R&R in prison. So if anything happens to me, it was not an accident, and it was not natural causes.
Right,
Put them on notice.
Right, exactly. And I don't think that's I actually don't think that's a stupid idea.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a press conference that you call, right? Here's the blood work. Dynamite, right?
But yeah, a whole PowerPoint with this whole like workup.
Vitamin D levels, perfect. Triglycerides, low. You know, I'm feeling fucking great. You know, I'm in a little bit of a jam here, but aside from that, I'm
a little bit of a jam.
Yeah, 2019's not going exactly as I had planned out. It turns out I'm gonna have to temporarily stop fucking children here for a little while. Oh, God.
Well, he didn't. I mean, in fairness to Jeff, from what I read, he didn't actually fuck them. He beat the meat while they massaged him or something. Right?
Mark. Maybe you should apply to be his defense attorney. That sounds like a rock solid line of reasoning there. Your Honor, Mark Spiegel for the defense here. What we've got here is your classic mix-up between penetration and masturbation. I've got some diagrams here. Oh, God.
Well, anyway, look, I don't know. I mean, does that actually make a difference in court?
Mark, I don't know. This is like when Dave Collum started talking about the ancient Greeks and, you know, molesting children. I was like, you know, maybe we should just get off the topic, Dave. I love you. Great podcast guest. Let's talk about the weather.
Yeah, you know, by the way, you know, Jeff, I don't know, he might have a good eye for him when they're 15 or whatever, but I don't know. Did you see the pictures of the ones, what they look like today, who are alleging this stuff against him?
I mean, that's terrible because, you know, these people are scarred probably and have been dealing with, you know, psychosomatic trauma for years.
Yeah, but that's emotional scarring. That's nothing to do with, you know, how much you're eating.
Yes, it does. What are you, insane? Yes,
right.
It does. Absolutely.
Okay. All right, fine.
If you experience emotional trauma, man, people deal with that in all different kinds of ways, man. They drink their asses off. They go out. They, you know, make impulsive choices. They drink too much. They spend too much. They gamble. So absolutely one and the same there. But
I don't know. How come so many really hot Hollywood stars claim they were molested as teenagers? They handle
well, Hollywood,
it.
There's been a number of instances where, you know, Hollywood has kind of been alleged to breed that type of behavior, right? I mean, look at the whole Kevin Spacey thing, right?
I mean, look, here's what I always tell people. Well, Kevin Spacey's an actor. It's a little different. But, you know, take a Harvey Weinstein, right, or any big-time Hollywood producer, right? There is no fucking harder way to make a lot of money in the world than there is, you know, in the movie business. It's
right.
Just the hardest thing there is, right? So if a guy is a really good businessman and he goes into the movie business, it's for one reason and one reason only, right? Because otherwise he'd be running a chain of furniture stores or a fucking bra factory and he'd make just as much money and have none of that stress. The only reason guys go into the movie business is to nail actresses, for sure. You know, that I'm not talking about the creative people.
Well, that's
like
a possibility.
The directors and the actors and the writers. Those people are creative. Although I think probably a fair number of actors go into the business for that reason too. But seriously, I bet the percentage of sexually harassing Hollywood executives is off the charts.
Off the charts.
Relative to any other industry. Right?
Off the charts. Well, what do you think? You think Trump bought the Miss USA pageant because he's interested in their answers to how they're going to come up with world peace?
exactly. Well,
these ladies have a lot of bright ideas, Mark. I need to start writing this stuff down. We're gonna piece together the globe based on their thoughts.
Well, I mean, you know, Trump made the money in other places and then bought the pageant, but guys who actually go into that business, it's for one reason and one reason only. So it this shit doesn't surprise
me. Are you telling
me
a guy that looks like Harvey Weinstein can't get laid legitimately?
Yeah,
are you telling
exactly.
me that women aren't just throwing themselves at that guy?
Exactly. The price earnings ratio of the looks of the chicks to the looks of Harvey, whatever that ratio is, it's like you could have negative 400% interest rates, and you couldn't discount that enough.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
So, anyway,
this is like that Chris Rock skit that he did when he's talking about Bill Clinton getting blown in the White House, and And he's like, all these Republicans are coming out and saying, oh, this is an outrage. I would never do that. And he's like, nobody's trying to blow you. He's nobody's trying to blow Newt Gingrich, you know? Like,
you know, actually, Bill, did you ever see Bill Clinton in person? Like, in person?
No.
Well, it's really...
Yeah, see him at my bar down the street all the time, Mark.
No, seriously. So I come from an entire family of libtards, okay? I'm the only one who's like, sane. And one of my relatives
is
wonderful.
Yeah, you're
sane. All right, you have a point there. But right. Anyway, one of my relatives, I love her. She's great. She does fundraising events for the Democrats. And, you know, years ago, they had us come. There was a fundraising event, a special showing of The Lion King on Broadway. And they had all the top Dems there. And, like, after the show, they all come out on the stage. And on the stage is, like, you know, all the Congress people from New York. And Al Gore was there. And, you know, I mean, you name the person. They were all there.
Sure.
And Bill Clinton was in this whole crowd. And he had this, like, inner glow like I've never seen before. It's like that scene in Schindler's List when the whole scene is black and white and all you see is that little girl in the red cape. Remember that amazingly kind of moving scene that Spielberg did? It's not exactly analogous to that, but Bill Clinton was in color and everyone else on the stage was in black and white. I never saw human charisma like that in my life. It was amazing. So you can see how the guy got as far as he did politically. The guy just has amazing charisma, or he did. You know, this was back around, you know, maybe 1999 or 2000 or something.
Right.
You know? So anyway.
Yeah. It's certainly going to be interesting what crawls out from under the rocks that are turned up. If this goes to trial and there's like full on discovery, and you imagine, you know, Epstein trying to cut a deal. And
he is trying to cut a deal, supposedly. Look, these things never go to trial. Remember, are you old enough to remember Heidi Fleiss?
No.
You know, right? So she had the black book of every star in Hollywood who used her hookers, which is, you know, it's always interesting to me that these major movie stars would use hookers, but people say you don't pay them for sex, you're actually just paying them to leave.
Right.
So that was like, everyone said, oh, the black book. No, she cut a deal because they didn't want that revealed. And before that, you definitely won't remember this one, but there was one in New York called the Mayflower Madam. And she was called that because like she was like descended from the Mayflower people, you know, whatever that group is. And
the Pilgrims?
Same deal. Well, the Pilgrims. I was at the pill. I guess it was the pill. Anyway, so same deal. She cut a deal because they were afraid her black book would come out. Of course, this was New York, so it wasn't filled with Hollywood stars. It was undoubtedly filled with business stars and politicians and stuff. So my guess is that this guy cuts a deal. You know, he'll like go to some minimum security place where Madoff is. But I'll tell you, it's not, from what I've read, like the lowest form of life in prison is a child molester. Now,
right.
He's one notch above a child molester because, you know, they're in their teens, but he's still pretty far down on the totem pole.
I don't think he'll get any love in prison, but you know, I don't think he's going to be in cell block D with, you know, the Miami mega jail guys. He'll probably, like you said, he'll probably be in a minimum security prison. But yeah, from what I understand from, you know, mostly from my experience in watching documentaries, that those child molesters, anybody who commits crimes against a child, they're frowned upon heavily.
You know, that's an interesting phenomenon. I mean, my guess on the psychology of that is, you know, a lot of people have to have somebody to look down on, right? So if you're in, so, you know, it's not that a guy, I don't think murdering six people is worse than molesting one kid. I mean, if you're going to rate those two things of how horrible they are, at least the kid is still alive. But the murderers look down on the child molester because they have to look down on somebody.
That's,
you know?
I think that's probably a fair assessment of the psychology behind it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So where is Elon Musk going to be put in prison?
Well, now that we've covered that, how's your Thursday going? That's a nice 24-minute introduction about child sex predators. We get that out of the way so we can move on to some. Well, first off, let's not talk Tesla right away.
Yeah.
What is the Fed thinking? What's going on, Mark? Really? I mean, the S&P's, I'm looking at the futures right now. They closed the session at 3,005. Okay. And gold is tanking, of course, because I'm long. And the Federal Reserve is talking about lowering rates again. Not only that, but Larry Kudlow came out today or yesterday and said, we should be looking to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez for our cues on monetary policy. Which, to be honest with you, the Fed is so fucked right now that it may not even be a bad thing. It may be so bad that it returns us. It's like in Pac-Man. You go out one side of the screen, you come back in the other.
Well, there's a lot to talk about in what you just brought up. So, you know, let's work backwards and let's start with this Cortez thing. Larry Kudlow has always been the ultimate free market, you know, minimum government intervention, you know, low tax rates. He's like Arthur Laffer is his, you know, idol, you know, King Dollar, right? He's been those things his whole life.
Right.
So there's one of two things going on. Either he's trying to, you know, co-opt her, or, you know, Trump maybe told him to, so she stops attacking Trump, or he's just lost his fucking mind. I mean, you know, he's had a couple of strokes. He was on TV the other day. He was almost slurring his words a little bit, although he seemed mentally okay, just, you know, a little slow. But there's no good explanation for that, because she is the antithesis of everything Kudlow has built his whole career talking about, right? It makes, other than that she wants low interest rates, but, you know, that's it. You know, he wouldn't be approaching for that. Look, the big question on the Fed, a couple of things. First of all, you say the S&P is at an all-time high. Well, of course, the Fed will say, hey, we don't look at stock prices. Well, they only look at stock prices if they're down, right? If they're up, they claim they don't look at stock prices. Right. So, you know, that's not going to hold any water there. They'll say, well, we're data dependent. The absolute joke about the whole thing, and I think you and I have talked about it, and a lot of people with common sense talk about it, is what the fuck is sacred about 2% inflation, right? There's been whole discussions about this. Right. We had it on Twitter with Dave Collum one day last week, right? I mean, it's pretty clear that the reason they're doing this is there is just so much fucking debt out there that they're just terrified of massive debt default. So they come up with bullshit excuses like, oh, it optimizes employment and it optimizes GDP growth. Although it's all fucking bullshit. They know how much debt there is and they're terrified of it. And they're trying to create enough inflation. That's their fear of deflation. Their fear of deflation is massive debt defaults, right? I mean, as Dave and I had this discussion on Twitter last week, the old saw that, oh, well, if people know prices are going to be lower, then they won't buy anything and the economy will collapse. Really? So, you know, if you need a refrigerator, right, and your $1,100 refrigerator is going to be 1% lower next year, you're not going to buy it because it might be $11 cheaper in a year? That's bullshit. Even on a $30,000 car, you're not going to buy a $30,000 car that you either need or want because it's going to be $300 cheaper next year? No fucking way. Especially if you finance the car anyway. So that's what it is. They just won't admit it.
Well, I think that's a great point. You know, because I always use the example of electronics, because the electronics is one of those things where, you know, the government doesn't really interfere. And so televisions, for example, the quality of televisions gets better over time. The price comes down over time. So the TV that I bought, I was actually just looking at it. The TV I bought probably 6-7. It was right when I got back from Canada, so it was six and a half years ago. I bought it was I think $16.99, and it was like the nicest one you could buy at the time. It was a, you know, nice 70-inch television, whatever. Well, I went back in the store today or yesterday rather. And saw the exact same television, also with 4K now, same brand, same size, also with 4K compatibility, which is the new high definition standard that you can buy. And it was like $6.99 or $7.99. Now, the argument that you're trying to make is that I would have waited 6.5 years to fucking buy a television for that, when the answer is no. And you know what I thought to myself? I thought, you know what? The TV still works, still has a good picture. It's provided 6.5 or 7 years of uninterrupted you know, usage for me. It was a good purchase, right? And that's how you're gonna think about it. You're not gonna think about it like, oh, I'm gonna wait, you know, because at some point you got to get a fridge, right?
Well, look, I mean, there's some percentage of deflation at which you'd wait. I mean, if prices were dropping 25% a year, fuck, you'd wait. If not for a TV, right, you'd wait for the car, right? But the difference between 1% deflation and 1% inflation, no, nobody's going to fucking wait for that, you know?
Right.
So it's clearly an attempt to inflate away the debt. That's obviously what they're doing, and all their other excuses are bullshit, right? I mean, that's it.
I think that's it. I think that's the only thing that makes so much sense that's got to be it.
Right. So let's talk about the broad stock market and the economy, right? All the data that you look at these days, or, you know, almost all of it, everything has upticks every once in a while, sucks, right? So the PMI stuff, the ISM stuff, my favorite real-time data, only because I got the idea from Buffett years ago, is the weekly rail freight and the monthly trucking data.
Okay,
and
yep.
And it's horrendous. It's seriously negative versus a year ago. You know, year to date, every month, every week. I mean, it's really bad, right? The economy is obviously going into the tank. And yet, you know, stocks are at an all-time high, right? So, you know, people are thinking, oh, well, you know, the Fed will cut rates and you know, stocks will do great because we'll get big multiple expansion, right? The whole Tina thing. And, you know, what they're not talking about, and look, I totally admit that this is a cliche, but the possibility that the Fed could be pushing on a string, right? Or, and as part of that, you know, that the E of the PE equation will fall like really fast, which could happen. And you know, so you won't get multiple expansion. I mean, you know, look at Japan and Europe, where they have negative interest rates for years and years and years. They have much lower PEs than we do. Now, in fairness, it's been pointed out to me by several people that we have more growth stocks than they do. You know, they're heavily weighted towards banks and stuff that gets lower multiples anyway. But, you know, regardless, with negative rates, in theory, you should have PE ratios of infinity, right? And you, even if it's a bank that you're buying or whatever you're buying, and you don't, right? So my point is that we can get substantially lower stock prices and lower interest rates. Now, obviously, if the Fed starts printing money and literally starts QE again, and even worse, supposedly it can't do it in its charter, but who knows, outright buying stocks like they do in Japan, yeah, stocks are going to go up. That's a Fed you can't fight, right?
Right.
But there's plenty of room for stocks to go down as earnings tank, you know, from now through the end of the year.
Well, and that will happen. The Fed will buy stocks eventually. I mean, I think it's just a foregone conclusion. I always say that. People give me shit. You know, people tell me I'm crazy.
Well, allegedly they can't, right? Allegedly it's not in their charter.
How many things is the Fed doing today that it wasn't supposed to be doing to begin with? I mean, we raise the debt ceiling every year. You know, it was what's the point of even having a debt ceiling? So what's these rules? We will move the goalposts as need be to accomplish whatever the absolute goal is. In this case, you're talking about inflating away the debt, which I think makes a hell of a lot of sense. But that is go ahead.
Yeah, I don't see the Fed buying stocks because I think that would be very difficult politically. I think it's more likely you'll see, you know, some form of helicopter money where they call it, you know, the people's QE or some bullshit like that. I think there's a higher likelihood of that. I don't know. Look, I don't know what the...
Were they just going to cut everybody a check?
Well, the Fed can't do that either, right? I don't know. You know, maybe it's a tacit agreement to keep rates low and we just get even more massive deficit spending, right? You know, maybe I don't know. I don't know if Republicans and Democrats would agree on this either, but I don't see them buying stocks. I mean, that's really fucked up the market in Japan. I mean, it's done nothing, and now they're sitting there stuck with, you know, what is it, like 70% of the ETFs or something? And obviously it's a much lower percentage of overall stock ownership, but I don't think they want to go that path. I think they'll figure out other ways to print and distribute money, you know?
Well, it's certainly there's very little margin for error. in a situation like this. And this is what I tweeted out yesterday. Peter Schiff always says you can't put the genie back in the bottle, right? So, I mean,
well, here's the thing. There can be a lot of margin for error for a really long time, and then all of a sudden, there's no margin anymore. I mean, look at Japan. I mean, they've on and off, they've had ZERP and been printing money for like almost 30 years on and off, right? And you know, the yen is still pretty strong, right? I mean, it's not confetti yet. I thought it would have been confetti 10 years ago, whatever, 20. And so this thing can last longer than you'd think it should be able to last, right? And then boom, then it's fucking over. But I think we talked about this maybe the first time I was on the show, but I mean, Japan's the one that should go first because right. They have the highest government debt to GDP, whatever it is, 250% or whatever, and they've been printing the longest. And you know, then it should be either Europe or the U.S., you know, and maybe Europe because the union breaks apart. And then, of course, you don't know how that goes, right? If the EU just winds up being, you know, Germany and France, the euro can soar, right? Or if Germany leaves, then the euro plunges, right? So my guess is it's the weak countries that leave, and maybe the euro soars. So I think the yen gets destroyed before the dollar. But you know, Albert Edwards today, they had a long piece from him on Zero Hedge. He thinks the next step from Trump is to drive the dollar into the toilet, you know, to help export competitiveness. Right. And because, you know, and in that case, then the euro will certainly soar against the dollar, and I guess the yen would soar against the dollar too. But I mean, that would be so hugely inflationary because we import so much stuff,
right?
That then you really got the Fed boxed in. I mean, if Trump has, I don't know what they would do. I don't know what Treasury can do. I mean, they would jawbone it. I don't know what else they would do. Maybe they would just keep issuing enough debt until the world chokes on it or something. I don't know. But you know, then the Fed's really boxed in. But they're boxing themselves in anyway. It's very hard to time. You know, it's hard to time. If they start QE again, I don't want to be short stocks. I mean, generally, I mean, there's always room to be short,
right?
You know, a fraud or a biotech or whatever. But you know, right now we're not there. Right now, I think we're still. Aren't we still pulling off? $50 billion a month?
Would you rather? Would you rather be long gold or long equities if they start QE again?
That's a great question. I think it depends where gold is. Look, I mean, if you look at gold
let's say it's at 1500, and let's say the S&P is at 3100, and they
start QE when? The S&P at 3100. I would probably rather be from 1500 gold. I'd probably be rather be long stocks. And I'll tell you why I say that. And I know obviously that wouldn't be your answer.
No, I'm interested. I don't really have an answer. I wanted to get your opinion.
If you look at a chart of gold as to where it should be, you know, relative to the amount of inflation that we've actually had, as opposed to, you know, buying it for future inflation, gold would probably be somewhere in the 900s now or something like that. You know, maybe $1,000 or something. So there's already a lot of inflation priced into $1,500 gold, you know, whereas stocks will soar nominally, right? The same way they did in Venezuela and anywhere else you get hyperinflation. So assuming we haven't had more inflation realized than we have roughly now, I'd probably rather own the S&P with QE than gold. Now, if gold were $1,000, I'd rather own the gold.
And what about silver? Do you look at silver or no?
I don't, because silver has such a big industrial component to it.
Right.
That it's like, you know, that's like adding another dimension to what you're, if you're trying to look at this as an inflation hedge, you know. By the way, I know it's sort of ridiculous and maybe years away. And so I'm not saying it's investable or shortable or whatever, but you probably saw that story about the asteroid we're sending the probe to, which
yes.
may have like
$1 trillion.
Well, you know, $1 trillion with the limited supply we have here on Earth, right? But of course, if the gold is on that asteroid or another asteroid, and if you can mine it and bring it back to Earth, all of a sudden gold is not a rare precious metal anymore.
Right.
You know? It may not matter in in my lifetime, and you're like 15 years younger than I am or whatever, 20, it may not matter in your lifetime, but it, you know, for somebody who says, you know, I'd rather own gold for 100 years than anything else, well, what happens if the supply of gold went up like 1,000-fold because right. we find it on some asteroid?
Right. You know? I mean, that's a great point. That's a very good point that makes a lot of sense. It was the first.
I mean, by the way, for 100 years, I'd still rather own gold than that new Austrian bond that wow. yields like 1.something%.
Right.
right. But anyway, yeah. So yeah. So look, I mean, look, we're very net short stocks, but I'm also, you know, I'm cognizant of the easy money aspects of things and the not fighting the Fed thing, and QE would definitely get me not short, you know, with something else maybe. But right now the fundamental data is so bad. There's such a disconnect between stock prices and that data that I'm willing to stay
but
short.
QE know? Is an inevitability. It is. So I mean, what do? Do you stay short now or do you just give up now? Because you know it's coming. And it doesn't matter what political party's in charge.
Okay, so I don't think QE is an inevitability with stocks at all-time highs. You know, they're cutting rates, whatever. I think there's – let me put it this way. I think there's a window. I think there's a window where stocks can go down 30% before that idiot Bullard – I call him Dullard – you know, comes out with his thing that he did three other times with the Bullard bounce and says, well, I think it's time for the Fed to do QE. Right, I think there's a 30% window. I'm not one of those people who thinks there's going to be a 70% window.
Okay,
70% plunge. You know, so I'm not terribly greedy on my broad. I mean, look, my index. I'm short a number of individual stocks, but my broad market short is the Russell 2000, is the IWM
yep.
ETF, because that's the one that has a gap trailing PE of 39. Right now, and when I say gap, that's a PE that includes the companies losing money, right? A lot of times you'll see a Russell 2000 PE quoted in the low 20s. They just throw out all the losers, which is absurd. I mean, you're buying the index, you're owning the losers,
right?
And you know, people say, well, that's because it's all biotech, and you know, they're buying that on the pipeline. Healthcare is less than 15% of the Russell 2000. I think it's 13% or something, you know. So even if you and by the way, some of that is legitimate profitable healthcare companies that maybe device companies, whatever, that don't have an exciting pipeline. So even if you want to discount that 39 PE by 10% for the whatever the actual biotech components, you still have a PE of you know, like 36 or 35 right. or whatever. So it's off the charts. So that's the one I'm short. And you know, lately that's been way underperforming. You know, the S&P 500.
What other individual companies are you short, aside from Tesla?
Besides Tesla, so we're short. And by the way, these are all much, much smaller positions than our Tesla position. We're short Carvana, which is, you know, just a joke. But look, with a wary eye, I mean, it's a crowded short, but we're short it. We're short Netflix. You know, again, smallish position, but I think there's just so much competition coming, and the cost of content is so expensive. You know, we're short. What else are we short? We're short small Square, which is a crazy expensive company. But the main reason I'm short that is I don't trust Jack, you know, the founder, CEO, the same guy who's behind Twitter. And you know, he's been so supportive of Elon Musk, who's an obvious securities fraudster, that I think he's got I can't prove it. I suspect that there would be dirt in his closet, you know. And in fact, they just fired their auditor like 2 weeks ago. And we're short Wayfair, which is just a joke of a business model. I mean, the margins are terrible. It doesn't scale, and you know. But again, you know, if any of these, you know, got bought out tomorrow, it's not going to put us out of business. They're all relatively small positions. So and then we're short. We have a really big short, but it moves like paint drying in non-US sovereign debt. There's an ETF. The ticker is BNDX, Bravo Nancy Delta X-ray, and we're short that ETF. It's got, you know, the average term of the debt in that thing is like 9.5 years, and the average yield is, I don't know, last time I looked, it was like 60-something basis points. I mean, it's absurd. So, and it's actually, it's a positive carry trade, because our broker, which is Interactive Brokers, we actually get a rebate on the short balance, which is considerably bigger than the dividend. So, but I mean, it moves like paint dry. You know, I mean, those bonds were down a lot today, and that thing was down 11 cents on a $57 and change price. But it's a big position for us, because that's the single most symmetrical trade I can think of is shorting that, like, you know, zero yielding or near zero yielding long-term debt. I mean, because it's it can go down, it can, but I'm not, it's not levered, right? So how much can you lose if it goes from yielding, you know, 65 basis points to yielding zero, right? You're not going to lose a lot. And at some point on negative debt, I mean, I've talked about this with people, you know, if it gets too negative, you just demand the cash and you store it in a guarded vault and you pay, you know, that's a business for somebody if this kept going, you know, operating like a bonded warehouse where you charge 20 basis points a year. And, you know, it's 24/7 guarded and you keep it in cash, right? Assuming the logistics of that are possible. I mean, you know, can you if you're some big company, can you go and demand, you know, 500 million euros of cash? I don't know. But anyway, so that's my favorite asymmetrical trade, but it doesn't move a lot. I mean, if you want it to move, you got to put some leverage on. And then, of course, it gets more dangerous, right? You know, then it becomes like, kind of paint drying, really can't lose much, maybe can make some money here to, you know, the notorious widowmaker. I mean, the guys who got turned into widows, it's because they put those trades on with, you know, the JGBs, they put the trade on with too much leverage, right? Then you get widowed, you know? So we're short that, and that's it. And then we're long, you know, like three little nano caps that are just, you know, really cheap, deep value, not cheap on earnings. You know, they make a little or they lose a little, but, you know, just sort of on an enterprise value to revenue basis, they're dirt cheap, and that's our portfolio. You know, I don't know what that is, 10 positions, something like that.
Mark, what's your most what's your biggest short, Mark?
Well, our biggest, I mean, our Russell 2000 short is bigger than the Tesla short, and, you know, IWM, I should say, we're short that. And our
you know what I'm getting at, damn it.
Our BMDX short is bigger, right. Our biggest single equity short is of course Tesla. Yeah.
So what's new with Tesla? Let me tell you where I am. I'm about 3 weeks behind the eight ball when it comes. The last thing I saw about Tesla was that they weren't issuing the bonuses for their staff that helped deliver their record Q2 deliveries. And I just saw now, while we're talking, came across the wire that they're going to be reporting July 24th. We got that delivery number, which was a record delivery number. What's new in the world? Fill me in and fill in the listeners that may not have listened to you since the last time you've been on the podcast.
Well, since the last time I was on, there was that delivery number, the quote-unquote record delivery number, which was about 95,000 cars, you know, which, by the way, let's put that into perspective in several different ways. First of all, it was around 5,000 cars more than the previous record, which was Q4 of last year. So what that tells you, first of all, is that this is not a hyper growth company anymore. It's a lumpy company quarter by quarter, because Q1 of this year was horrendous. The other thing to put in perspective is, look, I mean, Ford sells about 6.5 million cars a year, right? So they're selling, call it 1.6 million cars a quarter, right? If one quarter Ford sold, you know, 1,605,000 cars, right? Or instead of that, they sold 1,595,000 cars. In other words, plus or minus 5,000 from guidance, the way Tesla, actually Tesla was in the midpoint of guidance, but the expectations at that point for the street were like 89 or 90,000. So they beat that by 5,000. It's a completely irrelevant number relative to the market cap of Tesla, which is well over $40 billion. And, you know, and that's a bigger market cap than Ford, right? So it's absolutely silly the way people focus on that. But the two other key points to put that in perspective is, you know, number one, any market the Model 3 goes into, or at least a new version of it goes into, you know, it has a good initial quarter and then demand slacks off. So in North America, which gets the new models first and is by far the biggest market for Tesla, North American Model 3 sales in the first half of this year were less than they were in the second half of last year, right? So that's not growth. And then the other important point to put it in perspective is the only reason they got 95,000 cars this quarter, or last quarter, Q2, is massive price cuts. I mean, they put through, I believe it's 6 price cuts, you know, on various models since January 1, right? And the average selling price on the Model 3 is estimated to have dropped from around high 50s, like 58,000 or 59,000 or 60,000 in Q4, down to like 51,000, right? Or 50,000 in this quarter. So, you know, it's hilarious. Remember, remember the conference call when Musk says, you know, we literally have unbelievable demand for this car. It's just that people literally don't have the money to buy it. It's not in their bank account.
I couldn't believe that when he said that.
Well, the idiotic thing about it is,
everything.
You know, there's, well, but there's such a thing as a demand curve, right? Where you plot on one axis price of an item and on the other axis demand. And, you know, I mean, they could sell a trillion Model 3s a year if they cost $500.
Right.
You know, maybe not a trillion, but, you know, you could sell one to every person on Earth if it was 50 cents, right?
Right.
So what he said is idiotic. The key is, you know, how many can you sell profitably, right? And they're at the point now where, you know, I think, and a lot of other people think, they're going to still have a very ugly GAAP loss in Q2 and even a non-GAAP loss, despite the quote-unquote record quarter, because they had to cut prices so much to create that record. And it's just going to get harder and harder for them.
But is that going to register with people? I mean, the problem so far is that people are pointing to the one number and saying, ooh, record deliveries, you know, buy the stock.
So,
meanwhile, on the other hand, the financials come in and they look like dog shit. But people are like, yeah, but you don't understand. You know, they're growing. They're putting up record numbers. It's like they're fucking losing money. They were losing money for the last 10 years. They're still losing money.
Right. So you're asking a great question. And my answer to that is this. Tesla, I believe, is gradually being re-rated from a sexy, you know, hyper-growth story to just like a shitty, money-losing car company with a ton of competition coming. But it as much as I would like it to have happened, this is not happening overnight, right? So the first batch of people who realize that are the institutions who sold it in the 300s and put it into the 200s and at one point, you know, the high 170s, right, a couple of months ago. And, you know, now it's bounced back substantially as we're talking. It's in the 238s. But, you know, nothing goes straight down. I mean, look, I mean, this is a 30-something percent bounce off the lows, you know, at least so far. I mean, Enron had like several of those, right? And so, you know, it's frustrating to me because I think this stock should be under $100 because of everything happening. But I think people will see through that top line growth when they understand what ASPs are. And a lot of people do understand. Look, the institutional interest in Tesla is probably way down, you know, and it's probably being flipped over to less sophisticated people. But they're going to have a continual appetite for money. And, you know, the terms will be increasingly ugly for them. So I don't know. Did that answer your question? I mean, I think more and more people are looking through just the top line to understand what's underneath it.
Well, I mean, and here's what I see happening too. You tell me if you see this too. To me, it really feels as though the company is going to try and pivot its business model too to kind of draw attention away. Like what you're saying, the company's being re-rated as just a shitty automaker now as opposed to a technology company. And I think it's in the company's best interest to try to convince Wall Street that it's doing something else rather quickly in order to try and maintain this. And that's what I think, you know, all this, oh, we're going into insurance, oh, we're going into robo-taxis. I think
except that, first of all, this insurance thing hasn't happened yet.
And it won't.
They don't have the balance sheet for it. It's absurd. And of course, on a robotaxi thing, as you know, and everyone listening to this knows, I mean, another huge chunk of the team just quit or was fired. This was reported 2 days ago. There's been so much turnover on that team. They've been through multiple heads of autopilot, and they're way behind anybody on it. I mean, they're ahead of is putting something, you know, on the road that any of those other automakers could put on, which, you know, works fine most of the time,
right?
You know, on a limited access highway with clearly demarcated lines, right? And that's about it. And, you know, and if Mercedes and BMW and, you know, even Ford, because they have this, what is it, Aurora that they own? If these guys, I forget the one Ford owns. Anyway, if these guys were as reckless as Tesla, they'd have them on the road too, but they don't want to get sued out of business, and their CEOs don't want to kill people. And Musk doesn't look far enough. Musk, I believe, is a sociopath when it comes to the lives of his customers. And he doesn't. He runs this thing by the seat of his pants, quarter to quarter. He isn't. He's not thinking far ahead to the lawsuits.
Well, and when you see news like the news that came out a couple of days ago that you're talking about, which was, for those of you that don't know, something like 11 members of the company's autopilot team. All left.
Which, by the way,
all left within
10% of the team.
Right.
Right? Anyone else developing this technology, they have 1,000 engineers working on it. They have 1,500 engineers working on it. Tesla has this shit ass team. They don't even have anywhere near enough people to do it. Sorry for interrupting you.
Okay. So, like, 11 of these team members all leave within a couple, you know, days of each other, a couple months of each other. And all that's telling me is, and you read the article too, and the article was really funny because it positioned it like Musk had to let these people go for not meeting his expectations. And then you read the actual article, and it's like, no, the way that it read to me was that his expectations were probably far too grandiose. And this is what happens when you make up a bullshit goal first and then go to your team afterward and say, hey, can you do this in this timeline? And of course the answer is no, because the original vision was ridiculous to begin with. And then you wind up pushing these people, and when they can't do it after they told you that they can't do it, because whatever it is, you know, if I said to you, Mark Spiegel, you build me a fucking house from the ground up, and in 10 minutes, you're going to be like, there's no way I can do it. And I'm just going to be like, Mark, just do it. You know, like, I don't want excuses, just do it. Like one of those managers, right? Eventually, you're just going to say, fuck this, I'm out of here, you know? And I think that's probably very close to what happened in this instance. If I had to guess, I mean, so many of these executive turnovers and so many things that have happened over the last year or two, even 3 years with the turnover at this company, all they say to me is that the tone at the top is toxic. The company's culture is, you know, unrealistic expectations, unrealistic timelines, volatile, no accountability, you know, no shared vision, no mutual accountability, all the things that kind of make up a high-performing team. It just seems like whatever fucking mood Musk is in that day, whatever project. I mean, he's responding to people individually on Twitter that are like, Elon, can you put Spotify in the cars? He's like, yeah, done. Consider it done. It's like, it's nice that you're tending to a customer's need on Twitter, but don't you have fucking things you should be doing? You know, don't you have some things to kind of shore up first before you start going out and playing, you know, Mr. Carnival Barker CEO on Twitter, right?
Yeah, so they've had a lot of turnover on that autopilot team, and as far as I know, the first major turnover was the group that was led by this guy Sterling Anderson, who then went on to found one called Aurora. That's not the one Ford has, by the way. Ford has Argo. That's why I had confused them. And in fact, Ford and VW just signed an alliance. I think they're announcing it formally tomorrow, the terms, where VW is sharing with Ford its electric car platforms, and Ford is sharing with VW its autonomous driving capabilities. So VW Group. So it's going to be very interesting. And by the way, Tesla doesn't have a prayer against that kind of scale or any of the other scale in this industry. Anyway, when Sterling Anderson and his group left, there was a big Wall Street Journal article about it, and they wouldn't quote anybody by name, but they quoted sort of on background members of the team saying the biggest reason they left was this thing was not ready to be deployed on public roads the way Musk was telling everybody it was ready, and they didn't want people to get hurt, you know? So they were gone. New guys came in. They were gone. I think other new guys came in and were gone. I'm not sure. I mean, they've had a lot of turnover there. And, yeah, it's basically like, you know, Musk is making these promises, and it's just not doable yet. And it's especially not doable yet for Tesla with no LiDAR and a small team. And, you know, without going into the weeds here, you know, like the LiDAR sensors, everybody says you should have for redundancy. And, you know, Musk thought they were too expensive, so he pretends you don't need them. And, yeah, it's and, you know, there's another big lawsuit there, which is I don't know why it hasn't happened yet. But, you know, all these people who paid an extra anywhere, depending on when they bought it, $5,000 to $6,000, whatever it was, for prepaid for, you know, future full self-driving. And it's nowhere near happening, you know. And so these people should be suing Tesla for their $4,000, $5,000, or $6,000 back, you know. And you know, people say, well, maybe Tesla's going to recognize some of that revenue, which has been deferred in this upcoming earnings report for Q2. Maybe they will. But if they do, they're just a bunch of fucking crooks, because they're just nowhere near. Well, we know that anyway. But you know, this is nowhere near happening. So look, we've talked about this so many times. This is the most insight, craziest story, craziest company that anybody with a brain has ever seen, what these guys have been managing to get away with. You know, it's absurd.
And it never happens if the macro environment isn't what it is now. It just doesn't. You know, this company doesn't happen in 2008. The company doesn't happen in, you know, it has to be today. It has to be this macro environment. It has to be this expectation, you know, especially when it comes to the way people have been conditioned about tech companies. I mean, it's acceptable for you to just grow the top line, hopefully, and then everything else will follow. And in some cases, that makes a lot of sense, but I don't know.
Well, what's starting to happen here is people are starting to realize this is no more of a tech company, you know, than Audi, Daimler, Audi is VW Group, you know, or GM or anybody. I mean, every modern car has tech in it, but mostly it's a manufacturing company. I mean, you know, Tesla's going to have gross margins for Q2, maybe somewhere in the mid-teens, you know, maybe worse, but, you know, call it mid-teens. I mean, there's no freaking quote-unquote tech company on earth with mid-teens gross margins, right? And of course, that's a phony gross margin anyway for Tesla, where they under reserve for warranty, you know, and you know, shift a lot of stuff below that line. So it's not a tech company; it's a manufacturing company that whose products have some technology in it, just like every other car maker's products have technology in it. It's probably harder to make an emissions clean, you know, 30 mile per gallon turbocharged V6 engine the way the other car companies have done. There's probably more complicated technology and electronics in that than there is to control a battery pack, you know, but nobody says GM or Ford or Daimler is a technology company. They're more technology companies than Tesla is. Oh, because they have over-the-air updates? I mean, all they do is keep fixing things that are fucked up, you know, without testing them right, you know? Yeah, in theory, if they thoroughly tested everything and then put out the over-the-air update, fine, that's an advantage than going into the dealer and having it flashed on.
Right.
But when you go to the dealer, it's just thoroughly tested, you know? So, you know, and by the way, everyone is moving to these OTA updates anyway, but I'm sure they'll be much better tested than Tesla. Tesla just puts it out there. There's a whole mentality of Silicon Valley, which is, you know, that fake it till you make it mentality, right? And that's fraud. You know, it's fraud to tell your investors we have XYZ and it can do this, and then you go back into the back room and say, okay guys, we just promised that, now let's see, can we do it. Hey, you just lied to a bunch of investors. It's just fucking fraud, and it should not be tolerated. There shouldn't be any fake it till you make it. There should be, we think we can get this done, you know, here's our pathway. You know, we need to raise more money to get there. We're not there yet. Not, oh yeah, we're definitely going to have it next month, or we have it already. You know, that's fucking fraud. I don't know why that's not getting taken apart. You know, some ambitious prosecutor, you know, I mean, Theranos went to the extreme, right? But, you know, Tesla does the same shit with its alleged full self-driving and probably
a lot of
other companies.
And many other things, though. But, I mean, it's not just full self-driving. How many things have they done over the last couple of years where they've thrown the goal out there of where they want to be, and then, you know, he's turned around and said, all right, well, how do we get there? Right? I mean, that seems to be business as usual
right,
there.
Well, right. That's another issue, right? That's issues like...
Well, that's exactly what you're talking about, though.
Sales and production. I mean, yeah. I mean, you know, so, look, some of that is forward-looking, and it's hard to prosecute that, right? I mean, you know, a good example, we talked about this yesterday on Twitter. I was with somebody. You know, a good example was the Model 3 production schedule, where pretty much every single person at the company told Musk, there's no way you're going to get this done on that schedule. We haven't even ordered the equipment. We haven't done this. We haven't done that. And Musk went out and told the world that we'd be building, you know, you should have no doubt we'll be building 10,000 Model 3s a year by, was it the end of 2018? I think. I forget. It wasn't this year. I think it was the end of 2018 originally said. And so he got sued for that. And so far he won. I mean, it's being appealed because the judge basically said, yeah, okay, so you guys do have, you know, signed depositions from all these top execs saying that you told Alon he was full of shit. But Alon says, hey, I'm a real optimist. I thought we would get it done. I was motivating people to do it. And, you know, if I listened to the naysayers, I never would have gotten anywhere in life, blah, blah, blah. Well, apparently that's defensible under...
Yeah, that's insane. I mean, that's not a defense.
Well, apparently the judge said it was under SEC, you know, forward-looking... statement, fair, you know, safe harbor statements.
Right. Okay.
You know? So it's hard to win on that, but it's certainly easy to win on. Hey, I bought this full self driving, and you know, you don't have it yet, and you just fired half the team, and you know, maybe you can't win, you know, an SEC lawsuit, but I think you could win a refund on that. And by the way, that's enough to bankrupt the company. You know, if 100,000 people got $5,000 back. You know, maybe that won't bankrupt the company, but that's a big hit, right? So anyway, it's craziness. It's craziness that this goes on. And I mean, this fucking guy this past weekend was tweeting about robo-taxis, probably because he knew that the next day this story comes out, which is like, you know, 11% or whatever it is of the team quit, and they're not anywhere near where he wants them to be. He was literally the night before, two nights before, he's tweeting about it. How the fuck does he get away with that? You know, I mean, the SEC is really, the SEC is a joke. I mean, the SEC does a very good job, as they should, on cracking down on, like, you know, fraudulent fund managers, right? People running Ponzi schemes. When they find them, they put an immediate hold on them, and they bring these guys cases against them, and they should, right? And they do... I think they do a pretty good job on catching insider trading. And, you know, look, we could theoretically argue whether or not that should be illegal. But as long as it's illegal, they have these computers and they catch people. They just caught another guy yesterday, you know, doing it, right? But as far as policing blatant in-your-face fraud like Musk is doing, I don't know. They're useless.
I think the problem is that they're stretched probably very thin in terms of their resources. And I think... in a high-profile case like this, you need Musk to egregiously step over the line, which, by the way, I thought he did with the 420 funding security
tweet. Of course. There's nothing more egregious than that. That's what I've said.
Yeah, you fake a buyout. You fake an $80 billion buyout bid for your company that doesn't exist, and you put it out there. I mean, that's it, right?
Right. But now, you know, so he gets that essential wrist slap settlement. He violates it again. The lawyer who took him to court seemed like woefully unprepared. She comes in with one weak example of violations when there were many examples. But then apparently at least he got shaken up enough to not do that so much anymore.
Right.
But he still does it sometimes, like with that robo-taxi bullshit the other day. But all of a sudden we're getting leaked memos, right? Leaked emails, leaked memos out of the company, right? And we got a number of those. Right. And of course, no 8K filed or anything. And that was obviously Musk, who's a fucking wise guy who thinks he's smarter than everybody, thinking, oh, I'm going to circumvent the SEC and I'll just leak some memos instead of tweeting them or leak some emails. So then I assume, and this I don't know, this is just my assumption, that either his lawyer got a call from the SEC or maybe his lawyer preemptively called him and said, hey, Alon, you got to stop this shit because, you know, this is clearly you're trying to go behind your SEC settlement. So now what do we get? We get leaked emails or memos from Jerome Gillum, however you say his name, who's basically Musk's, you know, scumbag henchman, right? So Musk is like, well, if I can't do it, I'll have Jerome do it? Now, that I don't know. That's just speculation on my part, you know. But I know, I think I know how this guy thinks. He thinks he's a wise guy. He thinks he's smarter than everybody else, and he's going to play his games, and he'll just – he thinks he's one step ahead of everybody. It's obvious what he's doing. You know, maybe he's one step ahead of the SEC, but anyone who follows this, it's fucking obvious what he's doing, right?
Yeah, and once he started to shut up on Twitter and these emails started coming out and, you know, quote-unquote leaking, and it's always good news, the emails that leak. It's never anything bad, right? Number one, I noticed that. There are never any bad leaked emails that come out, and oftentimes they go to the Inside EVs or they go to Clean Technica or they go to Electric. You know, that guy at Electric has a direct line to the company. I mean, it's extremely clear, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, to Fred's credit, and look, he blocked me on Twitter a long time ago. And, you know, in a lot of ways, Fred is a scumbag. I mean, he would steal a lot of other people's stories and not credit them for it. And, you know, he would do a lot of pump jobs on the stock, and he would ignore a lot of bad things. But he does occasionally break a real negative story, which is more than I can say for
right.
For
he broke the thing about the bonuses.
Right. Yeah. Right. Exactly. So every once in a while, then he gets all kinds of shit from the fanboys. It's hilarious. You know, they think, oh, Fred has gone short. You know, and then Fred has to. I saw somebody put on Twitter like an excerpt. He was on Reddit, and he's like, not only am I not short, but I'm still long the stock. I just want to tell the truth. Well, sometimes Fred wants to tell the truth, but you know what? That's more than a lot of other people do. But look, let's just take a step back. Elon Musk is a fascinating sideshow. So you can have anybody but him run this company, and it would still be a disaster. It might be a little less visible because there's just a massive amount of competition coming in electric cars. It's not profitable to build cars with batteries in them. I mean, the battery is like a $12,000 disadvantage in the powertrain to a comparable ICE car. So, you know, you can see what happened with their high-end cars, which are the ones that had the good margin, the S and X. Their sales are cut in half this year versus last year. And a lot of that is happening in Europe, where the Jaguar I-Pace and the Audi e-tron are crushing the Model S and X in sales, right? And in a couple of months in Europe, the Mercedes SUV, the EQC, rolls out full bore. And, of course, the Porsche Taycan, which they've shown now almost uncamouflaged. It was the Goodwood Festival of Speed last weekend, which is an unbelievable car. You know, that thing gets the formal rollout in September and is available by the end of this year. So, you know, that's the S and X are basically, and there's, of course, there's cannibalization of Model 3 on the Model S, if not the X. So what you're seeing there to Tesla on the S and X, that's what you're going to see happen next year on the Model 3. You know, when Volvo has the Polestar 2, which is a direct, you know, sedan competitor to that, and Audi, BMW, Volvo, and Mercedes are all rolling out between next year and the year after small electric crossover, you know, slash SUVs that will, you know, completely crush the Model Y, you know, when it arrives, and also to a large extent the Model 3, because these small SUVs and crossovers, they just cannibalize the sedans. You know, people who think, oh, Tesla sales will triple when the Model Y comes out because everyone wants SUVs, no. What you have is somebody who wants a small electric vehicle, and they'll prefer the SUV, so they won't buy the Model 3 instead. And you can see it. I posted stats over the weekend on BMW of what happened. If you look at the 3 Series and the 4 Series sedans, and you see how many they were selling a year, and then as they rolled out the X3 and the X4 and I guess the X2, you know, the pie was the same size. It got like a little bit bigger. But, you know, 50% of it or whatever just shifted, or 60% just shifted over to the crossovers.
The product mix changed, right?
The product mix changed. So what you're going to see with Tesla is you'll see the product mix change. So people who want a small, you know, $40,000 to $60,000 electric Tesla, you know, that audience is finite. And what they'll do is they'll just buy the Model 3. I'm sorry, they'll buy the Model Y instead of the Model 3. And, you know, maybe overall sales will grow 20% or something like that. I mean, basically, between the three and the Y, and if the S and X are even left, I mean, people are saying one of those will be killed in order to make room in the Fremont factory to build the Y, right?
Right.
So I don't know. They might kill the Model S.
Mark, was Q2 the first time I noticed in the delivery press release, was Q2 the first time that they combined Model S and X to give that data on how many were delivered?
They issued
a PR that showed Model 3, and I was looking at my notes, right? So in my notes, I had a field in an Excel spreadsheet for Model S and Model X separate. So they must have been reporting them separately in the past, else I don't know where I got it from. Maybe I got it from a secondary source. But when I cracked open the Q2 press release, they showed the Model 3 number, and then they showed the S and X combined. And I'm wondering if it's the first time they mixed those together because, you know, obviously they wanted for optics. I don't know.
Well, in the Q1 release, I'm looking at it now, they mixed them together.
They do? Okay.
Yeah, no. I don't know what they did in Q4. I could take a look. The other thing that was obviously glaring by omission was they didn't reiterate the full year guidance of 360,000 to 400,000.
Right.
You know, there's just no way they're going to make that. So, back to what I was saying. So, you know, look, you know, the hottest plant in China right now, they're selling 40,000 vehicles total a year in China. Okay. You know, I'm guessing, and look, I admit this is a total wild ass guess. I'm guessing if they cut the price by 13%, which they said, or maybe 15%, because that's the tariff, that, you know, maybe they can double those sales. You know, I don't think a 15% price cut on a whatever $60,000 car, so it goes from 60 to 51 or whatever, from 50 to 42.5. I don't think you're going to quadruple sales on that. I'm guessing you would double sales on that. You know, so if they do, China goes up by 40,000 a year. But Europe, after they deliver it to the UK this quarter, supposedly 5,000, 6,000, or 7,000 backlogged Model 3s, the rest of Europe is in a slide, right? Because there's no backlog left in Europe after this quarter. And so what I'm saying, and North America is backsliding, which we already saw in this half of the year versus last half. So unless they drastically cut prices again, I think even if China doubles, I think they're actually going to have an overall delivery decline for the company, you know, until the Model Y is out. And then a Model Y comes out, and maybe the Model Y and 3 combined will sell, you know, 20% more cars than just the Model 3 or something. I mean, I see Tesla capped.
The Model Y is ridiculous, okay? To say that you're going to this is exactly what I'm talking about. To pitch that car to people, okay, and tell them you're going to put 7 people in that car, which is essentially a model.
Okay, so, all right, in Tesla's defense, okay, I mean, this is not a defense, but that was an obvious rush job to stop a plunging price. We don't know.
That's not their defense. That's not a defense.
No, I'm not defending them. Okay, I don't mean it's a defense. Take away the word defense. That was an obvious rush job to stop a plunging
Of course it was. But that's my whole point. My whole point is, how are you gonna show that to everybody and tell people you can fit 7 people in there? You got a room of people at the presentation, okay?
Right.
These are the people with, like, the biggest hard-ons for the company, all right? And they're all there because they all want to get, you know, Elon Musk's signature. This reminds me of when people used to ask for Des Walsh's signature at Herbalife. I'm like, what the fuck are you going to do with this guy's signature? Right? You got all these people there. They're all hopped up. They're live-tweeting it. Whatever, and then you unveil this thing and you say, all right, 7 people can fit in here, and then you got a room full of people looking at you like, oh, you know, is this it? Like, when those people are kind of dumbfounded and not buying it, I mean, how horribly offensive does it have to be to the rest of us?
Right. Well, okay, so that's all true, and in fact, their chief engineer quit between the time he announced that rush job of an unveiling and the actual unveiling itself, because obviously said, Elon, what the fuck
would have been
you
fucking
doing?
Embarrassed. Ready.
Right. But that said, that's not necessarily the final design of the car, and I suspect that the final design will have a raised rear roof and you know, a stretched platform. I'm guessing.
Sure.
Look, I don't know. Maybe I'm giving them too much credit. And you know, maybe you can really at least put, you know, 2 kids in the back or whatever, right? So, you know, I'm just going on the assumption that it is somewhat of a seven-seater.
Did he announce that they were going to take deposits at that for the Model Y?
Yeah, no, they've been taking deposits. By the way, that's a whole other thing.
Wouldn't you want the design finalized before you start taking deposits?
Listen, this company is – look, I don't have to tell you the way they run this company. By the way, that was another thing in the press release when he said – you know, in the delivery release when they said, oh, we've had an increase of net new orders or whatever. Well, guess what? That includes Model 3 and – whatever orders they might have gotten in China for the Chinese-built car,
right,
which they promised would be 13% cheaper and probably be even cheaper than that. So so my point is that the Model 3, I mean, the Model Y, if assuming that they – that what we saw the other day wasn't – a couple months ago wasn't the real design, assuming that they really do build a small SUV, you know, it should at least sell as much as the Model 3 and probably outsell it. But it's going to cannibalize the Model 3. And so what I'm saying is my guess is, you know, the overall pie between the two is 20% bigger. And Tesla worldwide, I think, even with the Model Y, gets capped in terms of demand at, you know, around 400,000 cars a year, you know, maybe slightly more. And that does not fit at all the bull's narrative, which is a million cars a year. And it's total nonsense. And it doesn't even fit the China factory, which supposedly will be able to build even this initial phase 150,000 cars a year once it's, you know, sorted out and up and running allegedly sometime early next year. I don't think they can sell 150,000 cars a year in China. You know, I think it's an 80,000 car market. Maybe it's a 100,000 car market between the 3, the Y, and whatever's left of the S and X. So people are going to be disappointed by that. But look, you know, you've got a stock that's $238. It trades 7, 8, 9, 10 million shares a day, 12 million shares a day. They could raise money. So this is going to be, I think, a steady revaluation, slow leak. You know, unless the DOJ walks in one morning and just slaps a pair of cuffs on Musk, you know, I mean, for doing something beyond the 420 tweet. I mean, who knows what the fuck this guy's been up to, right? If there is something like that, you know, then the thing just completely plunges. That's it. Game over. Probably instant bankruptcy. But short of that, you know, I don't own puts. I mean, because it's just hard to time this. We're outright short the stock. You know, it at least from a – it's a positive carry from a non-price-dependent standpoint. I mean, we're getting right now about a 1.6% annualized rebate on our cash balance net of the borrow. And that's what I'm doing. It's hard to time this. It's lasted longer than anybody I know thought it could last. You know,
I do know.
When you think it's over, it comes back. It's like fucking. It's like Freddy Fraud Krueger.
All right. Here's my last question for you.
Yeah.
Then I'm gonna let you go, because I know you have shit to do, but I know you actually don't. But I have to say that to make you sound important. We're both gonna hang up, and we're both just gonna be sitting around like, all right, what do we do now? Here's my last question.
Listen, I gotta go back. I gotta watch Narcos Mexico. I mean, we finally got it. This is on Twitter. We finally got Netflix. I never had it. We got it for free when we renewed our FiOS. They gave us a free year of Netflix. And you know, everyone said the best show overall to start with is Narcos. That was a fucking great show. I watched three seasons of that, 30 episodes. It's almost 30 hours. You know, the episodes are like 50 or 55 minutes. In like 2.5 or 3 weeks, and it just never got boring. So I still have the fourth season left, which is Narcos Mexico. By the way, you know, it's been talked about on Twitter that, you know, Elon Musk flew his private jet down apparently to some part of Mexico, which is like considered a very dangerous area by the U.S., and it's like allegedly the heart of one of the Mexican cartels. I don't know anything about that stuff. And then, of course, they had these, as part of the whistleblowing, these allegations about, you know, drug stuff going on at the Gigafactory.
I don't know, Mark.
I'm not saying there's a connection there. It's just interesting. So look,
it's interesting.
Let's just say that would be a bonus in my short position if he turned out to be John DeLorean. And I'm not saying he is, and I have absolutely no evidence for that whatsoever. And besides, John DeLorean was actually a good looking guy, and Elon is a fat fuck. So
Well, there's an investment thesis for you.
Sorry, where were we?
You know, my friend Manny says Narcos is the best show on Netflix too. He's been trying to get me to watch it for a while, and I've been avoiding his recommendations.
Oh, you haven't seen it?
No,
it's really good. And I'll tell you, the guy who stars and as the agent, the American agent in most of it, Pablo, I forget his last name. He was the guy in Game of Thrones who played like that, you know, bisexual sword fighting prince. And he was this great happy-go-lucky guy there. I mean, he was fantastic. He stole every scene he was in. And now he goes and does this, and he's this dead serious, you know, DEA agent. And he's really a terrific actor, this guy. I mean, you know, I could look up his name. Anyone would know his name. But really, really interesting stuff. And the funny thing is the show is so realistic that, like, thirds of it is in Spanish. I mean, they're in Colombia, and when they're speaking Spanish, and the bad guys are speaking Spanish, and the DEA agent speaks Spanish, you know, it's all subtitled. You know, if I had any skill at all for language, I could have learned Spanish just watching 30 hours of the show. Of course, all the words I would.
Yeah, you could have been. You could have been in the Democratic debate, Mark.
Well, most of the words I would have learned were different ways of saying motherfucker and son of a bitch. Apparently, it's puta, punta, puta. I don't know, but that's like every other word, but I have no talent for
I turned on that debate. They were like, all right, the candidates can introduce themselves. And they go to the first one. They're like, hello, me amo Cory Booker. I'm like, what the fuck is going on? What do I have? The SAP function on my television? I'm
well,
like,
the Democrats are pandering to their key voting key voting constituency, which is the illegal immigrant population, right? So, you know.
I mean, it's just a little ridiculous, don't you think, at that point? You turn it on, and then one guy speaks Spanish, the other guy starts speaking Spanish, then it turns into this, like, dick measuring contest of who could speak the most Spanish, you know what I mean? So the guys are going back and forth. Cory Booker's staring the one guy down when he's speaking Spanish. The other, you know, you got Beto O'Rourke's up there speaking Spanish. It's like, look, all right, it's, you know, it's just such a fucking joke. It's like these congressional hearings. It's just like, who can make the bigger impact? It's like, does anybody even care what these people are saying? You know,
listen,
like,
it's hard.
Did anybody know if they're even saying anything in Spanish or if they're just reading, you know, like the Spanish version of an instruction manual for their remote control or something, you know? Well, this sounds good. We had this memorized.
I mean, right now these parties are both, you know, doing whatever they can to lose, right? Obviously the Democrats... You know, Democrats all the way to the left, all this crazy shit, you know, free health care for illegal immigrants, no borders, we'll forgive all the student loans and, you know, all that shit, right? But on the other hand, you have Trump every fucking day tweeting about how great the stock market is doing when, like, this huge concern of everybody is income inequality.
Right.
So it's like, what the fuck is he tweeting about that for? You know, I mean, who's his constituency? You know, his constituency, I mean, he's got the votes of the rich guys, other than the rich libtards. I mean, the rich people know who's going to raise their taxes and who isn't, right? The rich people know who's going to re-regulate their businesses and who isn't, right? He shouldn't be tweeting stock market shit. I said this on Twitter today, if I were running one of these socialist left wing nut Democrat campaigns, I would just be posting all of Trump's stock market tweets. And I'd be saying, is this the man you want representing you when you're working in a, you know, sweating in a factory somewhere, you know?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of the, you know, regular middle class, even lower to middle class, I mean, some of them have 401ks, some of them might own, you know, a couple of shares of the SPY, and you know, maybe they don't understand how the market works, and they know that when they open up their 401k and they see that the balance continues to go up, right, and they might vote accordingly. So I don't think it's a terrible strategy, but
that's actually a fair point.
But
if people's biggest, and look, I don't know that their biggest concern is quote unquote income inequality. I mean, I believe that what counts is how you live on an absolute basis, not how much the next guy has. But if income inequality really is considered a problem, by the way, there's then it's obviously not helpful, right? There's a great chart today in what's that big collection of charts you get that comes in every day. I'll tell you what it's called, from Dow Jones, from the Wall Street Journal, the daily. Hang on a second. Hold on.
Whatever it is, I don't get it.
Anyway, so it's a great thing. You should get it. It's all kinds of macro charts, and at the end, they just have sort of interesting opinion charts and stuff. The dichotomy between the issues that Republicans are worried about and the issues that Democrats are worried about, it's like stunning. You know, it's stuff like, you know, I'm pulling numbers out of my ass, but, you know, 80% of Republicans are worried about illegal immigration, 20% of Democrats are.
Right.
You know, 80% of Republicans are worried about this, 15% of Democrats are. 80% of Democrats are worried about this, 10% of Republicans are. It's amazing the it's amazing where the priorities are. It's
right.
It's like it's so different.
Yeah. And you
it's
know,
called The Daily Shot, by the way.
Okay.
The Daily Shot is the name of it. Yeah.
I take one of those. Don't worry about that.
No, it's really, I'm telling you, it's really good. In fact, it's so good that it just takes a lot of time to go through it because they have so much amazing data in there, you know?
Well, I'll check it out then. Maybe I'll sign up. I get so many fucking things in the morning. I read Kenny Polcari's thing once in a while. I get that every morning. I get like 15 emails from Whitney Tilson a day. He's constantly sending stuff. I'm trying to think of what else. I get like 20 different morning things. You know,
So I'm looking at that chart, right? So like the way racial and ethnic minorities are treated by the criminal justice system, 10% of Republicans think that's a priority. 71% of Democrats do. Climate change, 11% of Republicans give a fuck. 72% of Democrats do. It's gun violence, 25% of Republicans, 81% of Democrats. It's the gap between rich and poor, 22% Republicans, 77 Democrats. It's amazing the...
What are the top concerns for the Republicans and the lowest ones for Democrats? What's the inverse of what you just said?
What's interesting is, I guess this stems to being a Republican... There's a Republican in office, so Republicans are generally pretty happy. Plus, the economy's been doing okay. But let's see, one of the few that Republicans care about more than Democrats. Is there anything on this chart? It's unbelievable. We're terrorism. So 41% of Republicans, all right, care about terrorism. Only 27% of Democrats do, because the Democrats want to let all the terrorists in so they get their votes. The federal budget deficit, 61% of Republicans care, 56 Democrats. Drug addiction, 67% Republicans. That's almost tied, 64 Democrats. You know, violent crime is tied, but pretty much every other topic that they, at least on this list, it's much more concern for the Democrats than the Republicans. It's amazing. Interesting chart.
What are your top issues as a voter?
Look, I'm basically what I would consider a moderate libertarian. So first of all, my vote doesn't even count because I live in New York. So, you know, Democrat is going to win this state like with 70% of the vote or whatever. I don't know. My taxes are obscene. Especially living in Manhattan, so I guess taxes are a big issue of mine, and regulation. I don't want more government regulation. So those are my issues, but those are very general things.
Well, it doesn't matter. You don't have to be specific. I mean, you're a voter. You're one of however many million in the country. So you don't just figured I would get your take on things while I had you on also too, and figure out what was important to you because you don't really.
Yeah, look,
you're not. I don't really consider you. I mean, you're obviously more conservative than you're liberal, but I don't really. You know, I like myself.
Well, I'm fiscally conservative. I mean, socially, I'm very liberal. I don't
me
care
too.
Who has,
right.
I don't care what adulting, consenting adults do with each other. I mean,
right.
Listen, I'm for legalizing drugs if adults want to take drugs, and tax it. You know, I'm fine with this legalizing pot thing
right.
if that's what people want to do. I don't really care. So, you know, by the way, you know, it's funny. That's the way I am. I guess that's the way you are. That's the way most of my friends are. And yet, if you look at – someone posted this again the other day, but it came from 2016. If you look at like a scatter plot
right.
of where people are in terms of, you know, fiscally liberal, fiscally conservative, socially liberal, socially conservative – what I am and what you are is like the smallest.
I know.
you think like, oh, that's logical. That's what everybody should be. No, we are the smallest. We're like a tiny, tiny minority.
Well,
generally speaking, the fiscally conservative are also socially conservative, and the socially liberal tend to also be big spending, you know, fiscal liberal.
And
it's amazing.
Well, I think that that's a product of a couple of things. It's a product of not really. Understanding all of the issues. So maybe you're a socially liberal person that doesn't really understand finance, or you're a financially liberal person that doesn't really understand social issues, or maybe you're, you know, liberal on guns, but you don't understand something else. And not everybody's going to understand, have a full grasp on all the issues. And I think, too, it's easier for people to just throw themselves in with whatever the party is, right? So if you identify as a Democrat or you identify as a Republican or whatever, you know, you're going to kind of check those boxes down the line. I mean, it's unfortunate, but it's the minority of people that examine the issues on a case-by-case basis and then kind of move the needle to whatever direction they stand on these issues. And then at the end, you wind up with this mishmash of shit, which is, you know, all together, you know, when I found out, hey, I don't really conform to one group, and then when you kind of mix that with my general apathy, I'm like, all right, you know, libertarianism makes a lot of sense to me, because I don't want to be bothered, right? I don't want to bother you, but I don't want to fucking be bothered also. And to be honest with you, I don't really want to discuss it that much, because it doesn't fucking get you anywhere, you know? So it is what it is. I don't think I'm going to be able to affect some massive change in the system, just like you know that your vote is basically useless in New York, so, you know.
Right, I spend very little time thinking about or worrying about this stuff. The people who tend to get all agitated and watch the debates and get all upset on it, they tend to be retired people with a lot of time on their hands. You know, one thing I try to do is not worry about anything I can't change or affect.
Right.
Right? Because what's the point? And so I'm not particularly politically, you know, involved at all or active. I mean, yeah, you know, it's fun on Twitter to make fun of some of these idiots like AOC or you know, some of the other Democrats. Look, I make fun of Trump too. I mean, I just go for the joke. I mean, Trump says enough stupid shit that he's a pretty good target.
He said yesterday he was doing a speech about kidney care yesterday, and he said the kidney has a very special place in the heart.
He said that. That's a great line. I mean, the thing about Trump is sometimes he's an idiot or sounds like an idiot. And sometimes he's really funny. I mean, he is a genuinely funny guy sometimes. He's got I don't know any Democrat who has...
Well, he just, you know, he just doesn't give a fuck. He just says whatever he wants. And some of it I agree with, some of it I don't agree with. But the idea of shooting from the hip... I mean, we used to think George W. Bush used to shoot from the hip, right?
We'd This is next level shooting
from the hip.
I mean, you know, they did that the G20 meeting, and again, there's something else I talked about on Twitter, and you know, Trump comes out, oh yeah, things went great, and China's like, yeah, things went great. They're gonna let Huawei or whatever you pronounce it, you know, sell their shit to the U.S. again, and Trump comes out and he's like, yeah, we're going to let Huawei sell anything that doesn't affect national security to the U.S. So, you know, I knew as soon as I saw that Trump either told China or led China to believe that this Huawei, you know, de-restriction was going to be a lot broader than it actually is going to be. And now supposedly that's a hang-up in the talks. I mean, it doesn't do any good to say, okay, we'll let our companies sell components to Huawei that don't affect national security and that they can get anywhere else also. Well, that's not what Huawei wants.
And if you don't think that you're compromising our infrastructure with these components, then you haven't been paying attention. I mean, because the company is just absolutely notorious.
By the way, it's a disgrace. I mean, Rubio, of course, tweeted that very weekend that if Trump, you know, takes them off the restricted list and starts selling them important shit, we'll pass a law, you know, immediately to stop it.
Yeah, it's a huge deal. And there was an article on Zero Hedge yesterday about some camera company that Chinese manufacturer of security cameras.
Yeah, there's no way, there's so many, there's no way to get rid of them.
Did you see that?
They're all over.
And they're sending the data back to fucking China. There's a backdoor in the software. They got them in our convenience stores. They got them in our gas stations. They have them in Washington. They have them in the CIA buildings. It's like...
Look,
and
if you're
going to make the argument, Mark, that like, you know, it's just conspiratorial, whatever, you don't know the fucking Chinese well enough, all right? If you think, you know, you're just kind of, I'm sure Huawei is 90% good and maybe there were a couple of bad, you're underestimating China. You're underestimating their intentions. You're underestimating their capabilities.
Well,
so
it's an interesting question. I mean, this Huawei thing, the ball is now in China's court, and they're going to have to decide how important it is, because there's no way Congress is going to let Trump, and for that matter, there's no way the Democrats are going to let Trump get away with just letting Huawei do anything in order to, you know, make a deal so Trump looks good politically. That's not going to happen. So question is this enough you know, look, saving face is very important for in Chinese culture. Is this enough face saving that, you know, that they can buy and that Huawei can buy enough of our stuff and, you know, we can and sell enough of their stuff to us? I don't know. I don't really know at this point. You know, it depends how bad China wants a deal, but that could be a big stumbling block.
So here's my final question for you. Then I'm going to let you go so you can watch your final season of Narcos. What's in Mark Spiegel's liquor cabinet right now?
I am really not much of a drinker. We actually have a liquor cabinet that's got all kinds of stuff in it.
All right, good night, everybody. Thank you.
That I just never touch. I like beer, and you know, like maybe you know, I'll have a few beers a week, and that's pretty much it. You know, my girlfriend likes red wine. We got wine coolers here, but I really drink. I like a good Belgian white. I like a nut ale. You know, I like good tasty beers. That's what I have.
Would you have a favorite Belgian white?
Yes, Allagash. I guess.
Oh, that was going to be the one. That was going to be the one that I recommended. Allagash white.
Yeah, Allagash White is a great beer. But you know what? Last night I had a very good, or 2 nights ago I had a very good Sam Adams Seasonal, which wasn't a Belgian White, obviously. It was a seasonal ale. It was delicious.
Yes, it's probably the summer ale, right?
Yeah, summer ale. It was great. The only thing I don't like are IPAs. I don't like that bitterness, typically.
I don't like the hops. The Allagash White, if you correct me if I'm wrong, but it's not Allagash. Maybe it's a different brewery. Can't remember. I don't drink a lot of Belgians, but one of the two has like almost like a pepper like aftertaste too. It's got a bite to it that would. It's not an IPA. It's not a hop bomb, but.
Yeah, I don't think that's the. I don't think that's Allagash.
I don't think it is either. Oh, what is it? It's another one of the like kind of trendy hipster Belgian beers, but anyways.
Yeah, but anyway, you know. So that's it. I can't really match you on the drinking.
No, there's nothing to match. Hey, look, we just have a beer here and there, no problem. Have you ever had Boddington's? That's what I'm gonna have a Boddington's here.
It sounds familiar. I may have. Is that English?
It is. It's an ale.
Yeah, I think I've had it. I think I've had Boddington's. Yeah, I think I've had that. And it's good. And look, I mean, just regular Guinness is a great beer, you know, at the right time. So.
Well, Boddington's very similar to Guinness. Usually, is poured on a nitrogen tap. And so you get those super fine nitrogen bubbles, and it's like very creamy, like Guinness is. You can actually get it in cans too, and they have a little nitrogen widget in it too, just like the Guinness cans.
Oh,
the
neat.
Same deal.
Yeah. But, yeah. Neat. Yeah.
So if you like Guinness, maybe you try Boddington's. That's my booze recommendation of the day.
All right. Next time I'm out somewhere that has it, I will definitely give it a try. Thank you.
All right, and then you report back to me, and we'll discuss it on the next podcast.
I will.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, Mark Spiegel. Thank you so much, my friend.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun as always. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely, brother. Talk soon. That was the one, the only, Mark Spiegel. And before I go, one more time, I want to say thank you very much to my patrons, the people that continue to donate to me on Patreon as I try to crank out more content here, maybe 2-3 podcasts a week as opposed to maybe the 1 or 2 I was doing prior, and try to ramp that up in terms of content, booking, and just generally spending my time on the podcast. The Patreons, they mean a lot to me, and they really do make a difference. So want to thank you guys very much again for your support, and I will be back. Probably sooner than you would like, fools. All right, talk to you soon. I'm the fuck out of here. Peace.